Colonel Gilmore, Reel 4. We were looking at the time you'd been issued with the Sherman tank, and you've described to us the tank. What about the roles of each member of the crew? Now, you would be a crew commander, wouldn't you, in the turret? What would you say the role of the crew commander was in the turret?
Well, he was the director of the tank and gave the instructions to the driver.
Through the intercom?
Through the intercom, yes. And you had a driver and a co-driver alongside you. The co-driver was also equipped with a machine gun. And then in the turret, you had your wireless operator and a gunner.
Now, would the wireless operator also load the gun?
And he was also the loader of the gun, yes.
Now, in your tank, you'd also have access to the 19 set. The 19 set had an intercom function, which you've already mentioned you'd be using. Would everybody in the tank be able to speak to everybody else on the intercom, or was it just the tank commander who could use it? Or you're not sure?
Not sure about that.
And would you be... could you explain what the regimental net was? Because that's quite important, the regimental net.
Yes. One of the things was that in the early days of the war, we'd been on squadron nets, and when we became an armoured regiment and much more closely integrated, we went on to a regimental net, which of course meant you had to be much more disciplined in your speaking, because otherwise you would take up too much time on the regimental net.
So all the wirelesses, the 19 sets, were tuned into the one frequency.
Yes.
And they were open. So anyone talking on the net would be interfering with everybody else. I'd like to ask about the exercises that took place. Because there's several ones. There's Operation Blackcock, or Exercise Blackcock, and Exercise Eagle, one of which you were the umpire for. And I wondered if you remembered what exactly these exercises were for.
I don't remember, but it was an exercise in the south of England, I think. The east of England. Because we were in the sort of Cambridge area and that sort of thing. But I don't remember very much about it, I'm afraid.
Do you remember acting as umpire at all for an exercise? Or what the role of...
I do remember that I was an umpire, but I don't remember very much about it, I'm afraid.
What about the trips up to Kirkcudbright for the firing practices? Because the Sellers, the regimental history, seems to imply that people weren't very happy with the scores achieved at first. Could you comment a bit about that?
You see, the first firing range we'd been to was in South Wales.
That would be Linney Head, wouldn't it?
Linney Head. And then we went to Kirkcudbright
I think it was around about December 1943.
In December of 1930, yes.
Round about there. Yeah. I think December and January you went.
January.
Now, how did you do? How would you say you did it?
Well, it was a much more open range, and therefore it was easier to operate from than Linear Head had been.
And how did the regiment do?
I don't know. I don't remember very much more about it.
the next thing. Anything else about the Bridlington area before we move on?
No, the idea was that the Yorkshire Wolds was supposed to be more like the countryside in Europe, which was why it was particularly chosen for training.
How about the people of Bridlington? Did they make the regiment welcome?
They did, yes. They were very friendly.
Were you aware of the build-up to D-Day by now? Because it was obvious you weren't going to North Africa after the cancellation of the previous thing. But by now, it must have been equally obvious that you were intended for.
It wasn't until we left Bridlington and went to Aldershot that one really got involved in any idea of a build up towards the invasion.
That was when you first knew.
I can't remember when we moved to.
I think it was March 1944.
March of 44, yes. We went back into Beaumont.
I assume it's Beaumont and not Warburg. In the book it says Warburg Barracks.
It could be, yes. I thought it was Beaumont, but they were there like.
And what about what was happening at Aldershot? What parts of the build up do you recall? What parts of the build up do you recall for D Day at Aldershot, the last 3 months?
Well, I don't recall anything very much. I think it was very low key.
What about the waterproofing? Because that was quite a big job, wasn't it?
We did waterproof practicing in some of the grounds round Aldershot. I don't know, any waterproof tanks, we actually took them and tried them out.
And what was that like?
Well, it was quite an interesting experiment and worked quite well, and turned out in the end it was hardly necessary because you got ashore so easily at the end of the day.
Would you as a crew commander, I mean you were a squadron commander, but would you help your crew waterproof or would you leave it to them?
Well, what one really did was to supervise the whole squadron rather than pay attention to your own particular vehicle.
Now, what about the actual getting ready for D-Day, the last phase when D-Day had occurred and you started to move up to Gosport, getting ready for, you know, for crossing the Channel? What do you remember of the preparations for that?
Well, my recollection is that we left Aldershot probably 3 or 4 days after D-Day. I think it was a Sunday morning. I have a feeling that D-Day was a Tuesday. Is that right?
I think so, but I'm not quite sure. But yes, it. And where were you?
Moved down to Portsmouth or Gosport, I think.
And what happened there? There was quite a bit of delay, wasn't there?
And we were in a camp there for 2 nights before we embarked.
What was that like? Were you cut off? I mean, was there a security cordon around the camp? Or had that relaxed?
We were very much isolated.
And then what do you remember of the channel, of the crossing?
Well, it was remarkably smooth, very calm.
And that would be, did you go with the first party? I think they seem to have landed round about the 15th, 16th of June. It's a bit uncertain. I think they went in more than one. Had there been any problem getting the tanks aboard, the landing ship tanks and the...
No problems at all.
And now you landed at Normandy. Which beach did you land on? Are you aware where you landed? It doesn't matter if you don't remember. But no. Did it sounds what you said earlier that you didn't have any problem? You just went ashore, not much water.
No troubles at all. No.
Now they then went to Cully.
Yes.
For about 10 days. What was happening at Cully? I mean, it was a sort of concentration area from the sound of it.
Yes, and this gave us as squadron leaders, we were able to do reconnaissance around the area to get as much accustomed to the Normandy countryside.
Now, how would you go out on a reconnaissance? What would you go in? Would you go in one of the honey-light tanks, or would you just go in, what vehicle would you take with you?
Well, we used a scout car. And I also used a motorcycle.
And did you go? I mean, as you know, they went into action at Shur, and Shur, I'm not quite sure how to pronounce it, towards Khan. Is that the way you actually went to reconnoitre? And what did you think of the ground you were to go across?
Well, one of the things was that we had never had anything like the banks which existed between Normandy fields. That's a thing which didn't exist in much of the English countryside.
Well, did the banks have hedges on them?
Yes.
And how high would the bank be, roughly? 3 foot.
Yeah.
And that was one point. Did you think that was good or bad for tanks?
Well, it did bad for tanks in that when you were going over a bank and coming out the other side, it put the belly of your tank, which was unarmored, open to fire.
Any other aspects of the countryside you noticed? Any other aspects of the countryside you noticed? You know, things that
I remember the orchards particularly being full of apples.
Now, did you actually go as far towards Shur to have a look at the German positions? I mean, did you get that far forward, or was it more you were looking at the what lay between you and where you'd attack from?
Yes, I think that one went to vantage points where you could see where you could have pointed out to you where a German line was, as you might say.
But you didn't get that close?
No.
Now, while the men were, while you officers were doing this and getting an idea, and I presume getting used to where you were on the map as well, familiarising yourself with where, you know. What were the men doing back at Cully? Because it seems as if they were doing nothing, almost.
Well, I don't think they were doing anything very much. I mean, the tank crews used to dig slip trenches so that you could, you know, get cover if you were out of your tank.
And they'd dig one that you'd have a slip trench dug for you by your crew, I presume, or would Harold Brown dig yours? Or would you dig your own?
No, I don't recollect what happened to the echelon at that time. It was rather remote.
Was Harold Brown with the echelon?
He was with the echelon, yes.
Would your tank crew, therefore, dig your slip trench, or would your tank crew dig your slip trench, or would you dig it?
I would take part in the digging, yes.
So you'd pitch in?
Yeah.
One thing that's remarked about there is that while you were at Cully, that they introduced the compo system of rations, which was quite new, I think. Had you had that before?
I don't think we had, no.
What did you think of the compo system?
It turned out, on the whole, fairly well.
Could you just explain what the compo boxes were? What the system was for us? Because they don't get it now.
apart from corned beef, I can't remember very much about it.
Anything else about the time at Cully? Now, the next thing then is the attack on the 26th, which we now know as Operation Epsom. Where and this is on the 26th was the first day was the attack on Shur. Now, what you were, I think B Squadron were not in the lead in that one. They seem to have taken it in turns, B first and then. What do you remember of that day, the first day, and the attack on Shur?
Well, I honestly don't remember it very well, except that it seemed easier than one expected to a certain extent.
In what way?
Well, there didn't seem to be as much opposition as one had thought there would be.
What were your first impressions of battle? Because this was the first time you'd been in battle. What was it like being in the tank?
Well, one of the troubles about being in a tank is that you're tremendously isolated. And between having to have earphones on in order to hear what messages were coming in, and also to speak yourself to give orders to your other tanks, you've got a sort of rather detached sort of situation.
What would you travel with the turret open or shut?
Yes.
Would you be sticking out of the turret?
Yes.
And you'd have the headphones on. And that would be the regimental net.
Yes.
So if the A squadron leader was talking, you could hear him. And
yes.
If you were talking, he could hear you. Is that correct?
Yes.
So you had to give your orders succinctly,
yes.
I presume. Was there ever, when a lot was happening, did it ever get confusing? You know, I mean, when A squadron were under attack, B squadron under attack, C squadron were under fire.
Yes, you've got... what I can't remember is whether we were always on regimental nets or whether we went sometimes on squadron nets.
You don't remember which it was?
And I find it difficult to remember.
Now, what do you remember that happened to your tank that day, the first day in action? You approached Sher, didn't you? I think they were leading at the time. And they went into Sher. What could you see of Sher? Because it was supposedly pretty battered by that time.
Well, it was being pretty devastated. You know, there was a lot of rubble and mess.
Was there any sign of the Germans in Sher?
No, I say that because we were supporting the 15th Scottish
Division, yes. I think it was the 10th Highland Division. 10th Highland Infantry were fighting in the village. Well, how did you cooperate with the infantry? Because that's another thing that's difficult to do in the tank, isn't it?
As far as I can remember, one had to do it verbally. You had no radio link with them.
You weren't patched through at all to their headquarters.
Yeah.
And what was it like actually being in a tank in battle? Could you give us an idea of what the environment inside a tank was like, or half inside a tank in your case? The noise, the smells, what it was like generally.
Yes, it was. The fact that you were in a vehicle sort of detached you to a certain extent from the action going on as far as the infantry were concerned.
What was it actually like? I mean, was it noisy inside a tank? I mean, people haven't been in a tank and they just don't understand what it's like. I mean, what was it like inside a tank?
Well, I think you were glad to be inside the vehicle rather than running about outside, which the infantry had to do.
Was it noisy?
Yes, it was, but you got used to that.
And what about the smell of the engine? Did the engine smell, or was it a smell of fumes and cordite after gunfire?
No,
do you remember opening fire yourself on that, that either the main gun or the machine guns in that first day?
I don't remember when the when we first opened fire. No, I don't have any particular recollection of that.
Now, after the day's fighting, which I think they fell back from Shirt to a lager. Now, could you explain to us what a lager was, how it was organised between, I mean, how did everybody know where to go, and what the function of the lager was, why they had to do it?
Well, it was in order to get your squadron organised back into troop formation so that they were, you know, could be a unit of so if you had each troop of your squadron together.
Now, would that would mean you had a squadron lager, not a regimental lager? Would that be the case?
Yes, I mean, what you had was three. I mean, one normally sent off one's second in command to organise a place to gather your squadron round.
And they now that wasn't the only function, because that's also where you met the A echelon who were coming up with supplies. Now, they, who would notify them where to go? Would that be your second in command of the squadron?
Second in command would do that, yeah.
And that's where you, the tanks would be filled up with ammunition and fuel and whatever else. Would they also arrange for spare replacement tanks and crews to be there as well when there had been casualties?
Yes, the regiment only carried a very small number of replacements.
So that was not a major function of it. Now, after the first day shot, we're not going to run through day by day, you'll be relieved to know, but I wondered, the next period of fight, there was another attack on Shur the next day, and then they went across the Odon to Hill or Point 112. Now, what do you remember? Do you remember the next day's attack on Shur, or is the next thing you remember the 112, if you remember it?
I remember getting up onto the top of 112.
Now, how had you got across the river?
Well, there was a bridge that was still usable.
Was it supported with fascines? Because they say a fascine bridge in the book, and I wondered whether that was a bridge with fascines to fill the holes in it, or whether it was just fascines slung in the river, which would, to me, cause a dam. You don't recall. Now, what was the situation in the Hill 112 area? What was the situation in the Point 112 area? What was happening?
Well, I mean, the getting up onto 112 was easier than we expected.
So there's no initial resistance? Or not much initial resistance?
Not that much.
What do you remember of the climb onto the hill then?
No, I can't really tell too much about
it. It's okay. What happened on the hill? What happened on the hill?
No, I can't really.
You don't remember the fighting on Hill 112. That's fine. Then there was a period where you were at Noyon under a lot of mortar fire, moaning minis, as they call them, Nebelwerfer. Yes. What do you remember of that? And what did you think of the Nebelwerfer?
Well, they were very terrifying. They, you know, they made a horrible noise.
What sort of impact? I mean, if they hit a tank, would they knock it out? Or were they more dangerous if you were outside the tank?
They were more dangerous if you were outside. But, I mean, if you... The engine compartment of the Sherman was always a danger because it wasn't all that heavily armoured. And you had these, what was it, five engines, and they were petrol. You know, it was petrol driven as opposed to being
diesel.
Opposed to being diesel, which was more inflammable.
So your view was that if a shell had hit a mortar shell had hit the rear of the tank on the engine area, then it could cause problem,
yeah.
a fire.
Yeah.
That brings us to the point of fire anyway. Had you become aware before Goodwood, the big battle at Goodwood, that the Shermans caught fire rather easily? When did you first realise that?
Well, one of the things is that I forget exactly where it was, but at some stage before we went to Normandy, there was extra armour welded onto the outsides of the Sherman, particularly where the ammunition was stored. And the design of the Sherman was a very straight-sided tank, as I say, and therefore there was very little chance of getting a ricochet off a sloping surface. It was very much a vertical.
So if a shell hit it, it would penetrate. Rather than bounce off or deflect. And what was the origin of the flammability inside? I mean, you mentioned the ammunition. You mentioned before that there wasn't enough armour over the ammunition. So that's one thing that could cause a fire or an explosion, obviously. You've mentioned the engines. Was it the two factors together that made them come to be known as Ronsons?
Yes, it was the two things. The fact that they were petrol-driven gave you a chance of explosion.
Okay, so you after the next thing really is then the big battle of Goodwood, which I know you used to know a lot about. I'm not so sure how much you'll remember now, it's a long time ago, but you did actually go back to Normandy in, I think, 1956 and have a review of the battle. Now, what do you remember of that battle now? How were you briefed for it?
Well, we were in being brief. We weren't, for instance, told about the 1,000 bomber raid. This was a complete surprise when we were lined up, as you might say, for the start of the battle. When this enormous amount of aircraft came over to drop their bombs.
So you just hadn't known that was going to happen?
We didn't know that was going to happen, no.
And what had you been briefed? What had they told you? What had they told you in the briefing?
I think we'd simply been told that our objective was to capture this, what you call it, Borgubus Ridge, to the west of Caen.
You hadn't been told how?
No, I mean, we'd been told that there would be a barrage which we would be able to follow.
Was it emphasised that you should stay close to that barrage?
Yes, my recollection is that, of course, the barrage could only support us for a limited distance because of the range of the guns.
But while it was being fired, were you meant to stick close to it?
We were reasonably close to the barrage, yes.
And you were meant to do that?
Yeah.
The regiment came round, they moved round to the glider field at Ranville, which is where I presume you saw the 1,000 bomber raid.
Yes.
And then at 6:15 in the morning, you saw the air armada. Did that delay you setting off, or was that built into, you know?
Well, I say that we hadn't been told about the air armada, and therefore we were ready, presumably, to go as soon as the barrage started. But the barrage didn't start until after the air raid was over. As I say, the barrage took over from the airplanes.